Good to see you all here with us. Mary Hagdon Dumont University here. The theme has been Elijah the Prophet from Tiberias Galilee to Tiberias. And we started with an introduction last week, and now we're going to get to some exciting things that to fire a prophet. We are a little upon there. And also the extraterrestrial disappearance of the prophet. Oh, so I now introduce Rabbi Eshalom. He's a wonderful teacher of Tanakh in California and throughout the world, in various lectures, in writing as well. We will ask him to take it away. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rabbi Finkelstein. We are in the middle of Perek Yudchet. I'm going to just jump right in. We're in the middle of Perek Yudchet. If there's anybody here who missed last week, I'll briefly bring you into the picture that the king of Israel at the time of Eliyahu, most of the period of Eliyahu, is a king named Ahab. And even though there are several stories in this these chapters about Ahab that don't involve Eliyahu, we're going to have to touch on them briefly without looking at the text, just to fill in the picture. Ahab sort of raised the standard in a negative way, or lowered the standard, but raised the standard of idolatry in the northern kingdom in Israel by marrying a woman, Jezebel, quite infamous in song and story, who was herself a member of the cult of Baal Zebul, and he introduced the worship of the Baalim into Israel, both and now as state mandated, and therefore it was things had really gone into a terrible tailspin. Eliyahu declared on his own a drought. The drought lasted for 3 years. We studied the story of where Eliyahu was during those 3 years. And now Hashem tells him to go tell Ahab that God is going to bring rain. And Eliyahu and Ahab are sort of looking not for each other, they're looking for different things. And finally they meet, and that's where we pick it up. We're starting from where we ended up last week. The yellow text here, and again, hopefully the handout was sent out in the meantime. The English text is underneath each chapter of Hebrew is the English text. So you can look there if you'd like. Vahikirot Ahab et Eliyahu. So when Ahab sees Eliyahu, who he has not been looking for, Ahab has been looking for some grass to feed the animals. Vayomer Ahab elav, hataze ocher Yisrael. And Ahab sees him and says, you're the one who's destroyed things for us. Vayomer lo achartik Yisrael kimata. It sounds a little bit like a third grade, I didn't do it, you did it. But I didn't destroy Israel, you did, uveit avicha, you and your father's household. And you think about it, each person has a claim here. Ahab's claim is, Eliyahu, you're the one who declared the drought. You've destroyed things for us. And Eliyahu says, the reason for the drought is not because I declared it, but it's because you and your family have followed Baal worship. Okay. It's a confrontation. It's a shootout at the OU Corral. Let's see what happens. V'ata, Zeliyahu, shlach kvot selai et kol Yisrael el har ha-Karmel. All right, so we all know where Carmel is. It's the mountain of which Haifa is built on. He says, gather all of Am Yisrael to har ha-Karmel. Now, something we have to keep in mind here is Eliyahu, this is happening somewhere in the middle of the 9th century BCE. Shlomo's Beit HaMikdash is up and operating in Yerushalayim. That's a critical piece because there is a prohibition from the time that Shlomo dedicated the Beit HaMikdash. There is a prohibition which may or may not have been lifted when it was destroyed, which is to offer offerings anywhere outside of the precincts of the Mikdash. Keep that in mind because throughout the book of Malachim, really up until the end, up until Yoshiyahu, there is the existence of Bamot, of other worship places for Hashem that the text is not happy with, but it's not a great tragedy. It's not like Avodah Zarah. All right, so keep that in mind. Batash shach fotze lai kol Yisrael har kamel, ben v'yei ha-baal arba miot b'chamishim un v'yei ha-shira arba miot, ochlei shulchani zavel. I want to spend a moment on that phrase, ochlei shulchani zavel, because it actually plays out in several stories in Tanakh. But who does he say to gather? He's the 450 v'yei ha-baal, and 400 in V'yeha Shira. It's unclear whether or not this is the same group and he's calling them by different names and identifying different numbers, 400 out of the 450, or there's a total of 850. And Nevi'eha Asherah is an unmatched term. Nevi'eha Baal is something that we see in a couple places in Tanakh. Nevi'eha, prophets for Asherah, is a little bit odd because Asherah really is an adjunct to Baal. It's not an independent worship piece. It's an adjunct to Baal, so it's a little bit strange. In any case, he says, gather all of these prophets. Now, why are Bamiyot? Because we will see later on in Perak Chafbet that Ahav has 400 court prophets. So 400 prophets seems to be some sort of a staffing number. And so these 400 or 450 or 850, however many they are members of the royal court. And at the end of the pasuk, it says, Ochle Shulchan Izabel, they eat at Izabel's table. Now, it may be that Eliyahu is being a little bit nice and not saying Ochle Shulchan Ahav, but what does it mean to eat at the table of the king? So we have to talk about prophecy for a few minutes. Let's start with this, and you please, you're muted, but you can speak by hitting the space bar. I want to hear what you have to say. What is a Navi? We did not talk about this last time. What is a Navi? Or what is a prophet, if you wish? What is it? When you hear that somebody's a prophet, what do you picture?
Picture somebody with a beard, a white robe, a staff.
Say again, what?
I picture somebody with a long beard, a white robe, a staff, you know.
Okay, so we have a Rembrandt piece of Navi. What do we picture as far as job and a job description? What?
Somebody who is a spokesman, so to speak, a messenger of Hashem.
Exactly, thank you. Navi type 3 is a messenger. There are other types of Nevi'im. There is, for instance, who's the first person in Tanakh to be called a Navi? Did anybody know?
Abraham.
When is Abraham called a Navi? When Sarah is taken into Avimelech's house and Hashem says, Hashem eshta ish ki navihu vipalavatcha v'chye. Return this married woman to her husband. He's a Navi. He'll pray for you and you will live. Now, Abraham, at no point in history, are we told, was given a message to give to other people. We think of Abraham as Mr. Message, but there's no specific message where Hashem says to Abraham, go tell the people X, Y, and Z. So we're going to call Abraham Navi type 2, meaning somebody who God speaks to and who as a result of that is imbued with the spirit, or in order to get that is imbued with a particular level of spirituality, but is not a messenger in that way. And then you wonder, so if that's 2 and that's 3, what's Navi number 1? Well, in Sefer Shmuel and in Sefer Malachim, and specifically in the story of Eliyahu and Elisha, we meet a group of people called Bnei HaNevi'im. And the Bnei HaNevi'im seems to be a guild of people who are studying in order to be fit for Nebuah. And they seem to be poor as shul mice, and they live quite ascetic lives. And they spend time in what seems to be meditation practices to try to get the spirit of Hashem on them. And there are stories where they get that. If you remember when Shaul was anointed, or Shaul was named by Shmuel to be the Nagid, he had 3 signs, and the 3rd sign was he was going to go home to his town of Givah, and there will be a group of Nevi'im who are coming down from the mountain, from the Bama, and they will be engaged with the spirit of Hashem, and you will also end up with the spirit of Hashem. And then you'll know that you're the man, and then it happens, and the famous saying, Agam Shaul Banavim, comes out of that. So we have Nevi'im, who we might call ecstatics, people who have the spirit of Hashem in them. Then we have type 2, which is Nevi'im, people that Hashem spoke to. Hashem spoke to Adam. Hashem spoke to Noah. Hashem spoke to Abraham. Hashem spoke to Yitzchak. Hashem spoke to Yaakov. Hashem, by the way, spoke to Lavan, and Hashem spoke to Avimelech, and none of them were given messages. Who's the first Navi who's a messenger?
Moshe, isn't it?
Moshe Rabbeinu, that's right. Moshe Rabbeinu is the first Navi who's actually a messenger, who's given a message and told, go tell Paro this, go tell Bnei Israel this. And he's given umpteen messages. Okay, so now, who are Nevi'ei HaBaal? Nevi'ei HaBaal are court prophets who work for Ahav, and that's important to note. They work for Ahav, which means, what are they going to tell him? Pretty much what he wants to hear. That's court prophets. To roll you a little later in history, Yirmiyahu alone had to face off against court prophets, the court prophets of Tzidkiyahu, who kept telling Tzidkiyahu exactly what he wanted to hear, sign an agreement with Egypt and rebel against Babel, and Yirmiyahu alone was the one saying, bad idea, and of course that's why we have Tisha B'Av. So, court prophets. So, what does Ochlei Shulchan Izavel mean? It means that these are prophets who are fed by the king, who are supported by the king. They're part of the court. And so if you look for a moment, I'm not saying, if you take a look later on at Amos, Perek Zion, there is one little narrative sketch in the middle of the small book of Amos, in which Amos comes to Beit El, the northern sanctuary, and presents prophecy of something that he saw, and the house of Yeravam is going to be destroyed, etc. And the Kohen there at that cult temple says to him, Lech brach lecha el beitecha, go back to el mekomecha, go back to your home, v'sham tocha lechem, and eat bread there. As if to say, eating where you eat bread is where you're supported. Right? And we find another story where Navi comes to the north, and the king, Yeravam ben Nevat, wants him to eat bread with him, and he says, I was told by God not to eat bread here. What does that mean, not to eat bread here? Not to become a member of the court, not to be supported. So that's just a little sidelight of something we see in this pasuk. Okay, back to pasuk Chav. Vayishlach Achav b'chol b'nei Yisrael. So Achav likes this idea that we're going to have some sort of a meeting between Eliyahu alone and somewhere between 400 and 850 prophets of Achav's. Vayishlach Achav b'chol b'nei Yisrael. So Achav sends the message out, and he also brings the Nevi'im. Now, let's step back for a second. If you are one of the Jewish people living in the north at the time, and you hear that there's going to be a gathering with the prophets of Baal and Eliyahu, what is it you expect to happen? What's the point of this meeting? So an important rule about studying Tanakh is true about reading any narrative literature. You cannot hope to comprehend what's going on unless you put yourself into the position of the people in the story. Who are these people? The people living in the north. They are people who are absolutely desperate because for 3 years there's been no rain. They're starving. They probably had people in their family die of starvation. These are desperate, desperate times. So when they hear that there's going to be some big religious powwow between all of Achav's court prophets and Eliyahu, what do they expect to see happen? Rain. They expect to see some solution to this. Right? So everybody comes. The Nevi'im are coming because they're summoned by Achav. Right? And what happens? So Eliyahu comes to the people, Vayomer, and he utters a famous line, which is a translation from the original Yiddish. I'm kidding, but I always like to pretend like everybody in Tanakh spoke Yiddish. Ad matay atem posachim al shtei ha'se'ipim. How long are you going to jump over two lintels? In Yiddish, how do we say that? Mekenish tansen? No?
I won't finish it.
That's two weddings at the same time. But he comes from here. The Yiddish comes from here. How long are you going to be jumping over two lintels? Now, what does he mean by that? He means it in a metaphoric way, but he also means it in a physical way. I'll explain. And then he presents the dichotomy. And it's a real dichotomy. Im Adonai Elohim, l'chu acharav. If Hashem is the God, follow him. Im HaBaal, l'chu acharav. And if it's Baal, follow him. Now notice what he says. Im Hashem Elohim, l'chu acharav. He doesn't say Im HaBaal Elohim, because he's not going to say those words. If Hashem is the God, then go after him. And if it's Baal, then go after him. Now there's something a little bit tricky here, because Baal is not one guy. Baal is really Baalim. There's a lot of different Baalim. But he's talking in the generic sense. So what is Eliyahu calling the people on? So we have to step back. We'll finish the pasuk. We'll step back. Belona anu ha'am oto davar. They had nothing. They couldn't respond. Why couldn't they respond? Because they didn't recognize the question. They didn't recognize the challenge. This was foreign to them, of saying either pick God or Baal. Why? Pick Hashem or Baal? Because the people from the earliest days, most of them had been practicing something we refer to as syncretism. In other words, we were taken out of Mitzrayim, we had Matan HaTorah, we had the man every day, we believe in Hashem, we've come to a land And the mode of thinking consistently through that period was that gods have control over territory. We've come to a land where the Baalim have control over the territory. And therefore, just in case, we better worship Baal to make sure that, you know, okay, fine, Hashem's good, but I got to worship Baal. So they would worship Hashem and Baal, both of them. And that's something we refer to as syncretism, syncretistic worship, worshiping together. Eliyahu presents something to them that to a pagan, a pagan ear is foreign. Paganism, by the way, is very tolerant. And I don't mean that in a positive way. But a pagan will say, you know what, I'm visiting this town. I will worship the local god because the local god has some power and I don't want to hurt people, insult people. And my god is not an exclusive god. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when he first introduced himself to us, introduced himself as Elkanah. I am a jealous god in the sense that I demand exclusivity. And so Eliyahu presents something to them, to their ears as foreign, that you have to make that choice. But he forced them to make the choice. And they have nothing to say. So what's going to happen here? Vayomer Eliyahu el ha'am, ani notarti navi l'Adonai levadi. He said, I'm the only one who is a navi l'Hashem. And by the way, it's not exactly true because remember, there's 100 Nevi'im that Ovadia saved in two caves. But we don't know about them. Plus, those are evidently Nevi'im type 1 or 2, not type 3. It says, I'm the only one who's a true messenger of God. Messenger. You got 450 of these guys. It's 1 versus 450. That's pretty long odds. All right, so let me present a scenario to you. All right, we should be given, or they should give to us, two oxen. They can pick whichever one they want, and they should slaughter it and cut it up. Put it on a pile of wood. But no fire. I'll do the other one. I'll do the same thing. So in other words, we're going to set up two altars. Altar A and altar B. A for Adoshem, B for Baal. And they're going to put wood on their altar. I'll put wood on my altar. We're going to give you get to pick whichever ox you want. You pick the fat ox, the thin ox, whatever you want. I'll take the other one. We'll slaughter it. We'll cut up, put the pieces on top of the wood. And then what's going to happen? You call out in the name of your God, and I'll call out in the name of Hashem. And the one who answers with fire will be proven to be the real God. And everybody says, that's good, good idea. Now, in the people's mind, what should happen? The people here have not denied Hashem. In the people's mind, what should happen? What do they expect to see happen?
So again, everybody will call out.
And what will happen?
And there'll be fire everywhere.
Right? Fire on both altars, right?
Both of them, everywhere.
In other words, Baal has powers, and there's a Baal of fire, so they'll call out to the fire Baal. And Hashem has powers, and so there'll be fire on both. Which, by the way, will then demonstrate that Eliyahu's dichotomy is a false dichotomy. That's perhaps what they expect. So they say, Tov HaDavar, remember, they didn't respond when Eliyahu says, pick the God. But when Eliyahu says, here's how we're going to prove it, they said, okay, that's good. Because the reality is that that may prove Eliyahu wrong and them right, and may not. Okay. Vayomer Eliyahu l'Nevi HaBaal. And by the way, let me just ask this question. Let's say it plays out the way, which it does, the way that Eliyahu wants it to. That means what do we now expect the people to do? Because the people are signing on to this agreement. So if only Hashem's Mizbeach has fire and the other one doesn't, what do we expect the people to do? What is Eliyahu challenging them to do if fire only comes down on the Mizbeach of Hashem?
To recognize that the Baal is a Baal and not...
Baal is garnished. Baal is garnished, right? Right? The Baal is meaningless, right? And to forsake the Baal, correct? Mm-hmm. Now, that means that Eliyahu is... educationally, planning to bring the people around to the belief in Hashem through what? Through education?
Visual aids, right?
Through more than visual aids, through what?
More than experiential education?
Much more than experience. Experiential education is a great show.
Miracles?
Through
what?
Miracles. Through miracles.
Miracles.
Mind-blowing miracles. Fire coming out of heaven on one Mizbeach and missing the other one, and it's going to make an even greater miracle. One of the questions is that effective, and is that a true way to bring people around to belief? We'll leave it for a little further in chapter, but we'll see that there's a failure in this. Okay. Now, by the way, that means that unlike baseball, here, the home team goes first. There's more of you than me, so you get to go first. And by the way, they could have turned around and said the opposite. You're our guest. You go first. We'll talk about what the psychology of this is. It's a very powerful thing about group dynamics. You call out in the name of your God and don't put any fire there. All right? And they do it. Now, let me ask you this. Before we go any further, because I think you know how the story plays out, but before we go any further, what option does Achav, what option do the Nevi'ah Baal have? What option do the people have at this point? And they always said, okay, you got to make a choice between one God and the other. What option do the people have at this point? What could they have said? They could have said, no, we don't want to choose between. We like them both. They could have said that. They didn't answer anything. Second thing is, he then proposes his competition. And at that point, they could have said, that doesn't prove anything. Maybe you know magic. Right? So they could have done that. The third thing is, who else could have responded differently? Who are the groups here? There's Achav and the court. Achav. There's the people. Who else is there here? Because we need everybody to
play. The prophets.
What could the Baal prophets have said at this point?
We had a bad day, maybe. No,
before that, right now. Before the excuse.
Well, they could have said, we don't want to do it.
Right,
We don't want to do it.
So there's a phenomenon that we are familiar with. We're familiar with it from our own lives. And I'll bring you to something that for many of us, I see a few faces there, for many of us is something that we still remember visually. In 1993, there was a meeting at the Rose Garden. Do you remember the meeting between President Clinton and Yitzhak Rabin, Alav Shalom? This week was his Yahrzeit, at least the English calendar, and Yimach Shmo, the fellow from Ramallah. And this was Oslo, and okay, I'm sorry, I can't say his name. He's, you know, killed too many Jews, I can't bring it up, but you know who I'm talking about. And Rabin did not want to shake his hand. We know that, but we could also see it. If you watched it, you could see it. And the Arab put his hand out on camera in front of the whole world. Rabin had no choice. He had to shake his hand. It was a brilliant move. It was a brilliant move because he got Rabin to shake his hand. He couldn't have no choice. He couldn't stand there and you're signing an agreement, but I won't touch you. It's called social opprobrium. And it works. I'll give you an example from a story that you know in Tanakh that's not this, then another story that's not this, and I'll bring it around because I think there's a crucial point going on in this story. When Boaz, end of Ruth, you guys all familiar with the story of Ruth? Okay. When Boaz, in the beginning of the fourth chapter, comes to negotiate in order to be able to marry Ruth, he has to deal with a guy who's got no name. The guy's the Goel. Poni Almoni, whatever his real name is, we don't know. And Boaz wants to get Ploni Almoni, and he offers him a false dichotomy also. He says, if you want the land, you got to marry Ruth. To which, by the way, Ploni Almoni could have said, nah, I'll take the land. You take Ruth. But what does Boaz do first? Boaz assembles 10 elders. Now, by the way, this is the gate of the city early in the morning during harvest season, which means everybody's on their way out of the city to go harvest. And they see a big gathering at the court. What do they all do? They do whatever you do when you're driving on the freeway or something and you see an accident, stop the car and look. Everybody comes to look. So we've got the whole town there. Everybody's there. And now everybody's there, and he's got Ploni Almoni standing in the middle, and he says to him, do you want the field? He says, yes, I want the field. He says, okay, you really want to do the full mitzvah of redeeming the name of Elimelech? Here's how to do it. Marry Ruth also. And he put him on the spot. because he can't admit in front of everybody, oh, I just wanted the field because I like the land. So he got him to back off from everything. Had he met with him privately, the guy would have kept the land and Boaz would have gotten Ruth. He used social opprobrium to push the guy to back off of everything. And I'll give you another example of it. In what's got to be one of the weirdest scenes, what is the most famous man-on-man, one-on-one battle in Tanakh? Which, by the way, becomes a metaphor for every sports writer.
David and Goliath?
Yeah, David and Goliath, exactly. Every time that some fly-by-night team, every time that the YU Maccabees win another game in their amazing winning streak, it's David beating Goliath. David and Goliath. How does that David and Goliath thing happen? Somebody there has some noise going on in the background, if you can mute, please. How does it happen? B'nai Israel are encamped on one side of the Nahal, and the Plishtim are encamped on the other side. And they're about to go to war. And suddenly Goliath walks out and yells and says, listen, why should we go to war? I'm a Plishti. You guys are Avadim Shaul. Send out one guy who'll do battle against me. If he beats me and if I beat him. Which, by the way, is ridiculous. Who would say yes to that? So what should Shaul have said at that point? He should have said, no, I don't want your deal. We'll go to war like a regular war. Nobody thought of doing that. And for 40 days, they sat there with their tail between the legs, scared, until some kid came out with a slingshot. But you think about it, why doesn't somebody turn around to Goliath and say, nah, we don't want to go one-on-one. You're a monster. We'd rather go army against army. Because there's something that happens when you have this public stand and you present what seems to be like a challenge to your manhood, to your virility, to your strength, to your pride, whatever. It's very hard to back down. And that's what happens here. The Baalim could have said, nah, we don't want to play this game. But of course, if they do that, they look weak. So they got to go along with it. And the people could have said to Eliyahu, you know what? We kind of like this syncretism. But then they look weak. They look like, well, we're not really capable of standing up to a challenge. Eliyahu is brilliant in how he gets everybody to buy into his plan. Now let's see how the plan plays out. Okay. Vayichu et hapar, verse Chafav. So this is going all day, all morning. The Baal prophets are screaming out to Baal, Anenu, Anenu, Anenu. Ein kol ve'ein oneh. Right? There's no sound and there's no response. What does Ein kol ve'ein oneh mean? Like, that's a weird phrase. What is it that we expect to happen that didn't happen? I would have said Ein eish. But ain kol ve'ain oneh, it might be sort of an idiom of saying there's no response. What happens? Va'yifaschu al mizbeach asher asah. They start jumping up and down or jumping on the mizbeach that Eliyahu had set up. By the way, that's pretty funny because what does that mean if they're jumping on the mizbeach? That means that it looks like they're ready to, if the fire comes, to be in the fire. Remember, they're praying for the wood that's on the mizbeach to get inflamed. What happens if you're standing on the mizbeach when the fire comes down? Ever hear of two guys named Nadav and Avihu? Yeah, but you become
be burned to a crisp.
Just kabal, right? So they're going quite extreme in this behavior. Now let me ask you a question: what do the Baal prophets actually expect to have happen? We got to climb inside.
They expected the fire to come down and burn, accept the sacrifice.
Based on what? Based on what? Why would they think that? So either there's some shenanigans going on, and there's a midrash about that they sent the guy underneath with a fire and then a snake bit him, or else they truly believe that the Baalim have the ability to make fire. But let me ask you, why would the Baalim do that? And this is where we get to a crucial difference between Torah and our belief and pagan beliefs. There are many differences. This is a crucial difference. If you think about it, throughout the history of Am Yisrael, one of the themes that, by the way, becomes a saving theme for us consistently is Kiddush Hashem. Kiddush Hashem. When Hashem wants to destroy us after the Egel, how does Moshe convince him not to do it? Why should the nation say that you had strength to bring them out of Mitzrayim, but you didn't have strength to bring them to Canaan, so therefore you killed them in the desert? Your name is going to be destroyed. When Yoshua, the Perek Zion, falls on his face before God after the loss at Ha'ai, he says, Umata Selashim Chagagol, what's going to happen to your great name when people see that your people lost? HaKadosh Baruch Hu has skin in the game. And therefore we understand, and we're going to see it later in Eliyahu's prayer, we have expectation Hashem is going to make the fire come down because Hashem wants to reestablish his name as being the one God. Why would the Baalim, if there is such a thing, and of course it isn't, but if you're a Navi Baal, and you believe that the Baalim really have power, why would they take an interest in putting fire here? For what purpose? You see the problem? The Baalim don't have any skin in the game. They don't care if people believe in them or not, in their religion. So therefore, they don't have any interest in saying, oh, I'm going to make it burn so that all those Jewish people can worship me. They don't have that. We transpose the way we understand Hashem and the way Tanakh presents Hashem to us. We transpose that to Baal, but that's not necessarily the case. So why would they expect that the Baalim would make the fire happen? And by the way, this goes on all morning, which means, what are they thinking is happening? We're crying out, the fire's not coming, we're going to cry out more, we're going to do crazier things, jump up and down on his back. It's going to get weirder and worse. What are they thinking? So let's read the rest of this and come back to that question. All right, now. Vahimat Sorayim, so it's right at midday. Vayatel by Eliyahu. Eliyahu starts teasing them. Vayomer kiru b'kol gadol ki Elohimu kisiach v'chisiglo v'chiderechlo. You better call out loudly. He's a god. Maybe he's on a trip. Maybe he's gone somewhere. Ulay Hashenu v'ikatz. Maybe he's far shlofen. You got to wake him up. Eliyahu is making fun of them. At no point are the prophets going to say, "Oh yeah, I forgot. It's nap time today. We'll call him later." They're not going to admit to that. Eliyahu's making fun of them. But he has good reason to make fun of them. Besides, the general thing is, look at these guys. What are they doing? They're jumping up and down, hollering, screaming, doing whatever they're doing for hours on end that Baal should make the fire come down, and it's not happening. Now, the obvious thing to everybody standing there is these guys don't know what they're doing. And maybe their God's not real. Maybe their God's not real. Maybe these guys don't know what they're doing. The court prophets, what do we know? Vayikru b'kol gadol, and then vayikodedu k'mishpatam. Then they start cutting themselves, as is their religion. V'charavot uv'machim. They take swords, they take lances, or spears, and they cut themselves. Ad shvachtam alim, until they started bleeding. Wow. Vayhi kavorat sorayim, and now you have a weird word. Vayitnabu ad lalot hamincha. It's a strange phrase. The noontime passes and they continue to prophesize, which is what we're describing here is actually their mantic behavior and manic behavior until the time of the mincha. What does that mean? And kol vein onev ein kashiv. Nobody's listening. Nobody. They got no response. Baal's asleep. Baal is away. Baal's on vacation. Baal's not picking up his phone. Okay. Now, ad lalot mincha is an interesting problem that comes back to something I mentioned earlier. What is Eliyahu going to do next after the Baalim have washed out? What is it Eliyahu wants to do?
He wants to prove the miracle.
And how's he going to do it?
And to implore Hashem to send down fire.
Beautiful. And when Hashem sends down the fire, what will we now have in front of us? A korban. Oops, that's a little bit of a problem because we are not on Har Tzion, we're on Har Karmel. This is a problem of offering a korban outside of the Mikdash. Chazal deal with this problem, and they say this is one of those few examples of an employing the pasuk, Eit lasot Hashem eferu toratecha. Sometimes in order to do at work for Hashem, sometimes you have to violate one of the laws. Chazal applied this famously to writing down Torah Shebaal Peh. Eid la'asot la'adonai fevor Torah Eliyahu Bahar Karmel. Rav Yoel Ben Nun points out, though, it's in a footnote, one of his articles, I forgot where. He points out that this was after La'alotam Incha, and he claims that the Isur of Akorbat Chutz, of offering a Korban outside of the precincts of the Mikdash, may be less intense or not exist after Korbanot in the Mikdash are already brought. So it's as if it's say Eliyahu waited till the late afternoon, so in Yerushalayim, the afternoon Tamid's already been brought. So it could be the reason for that. Maybe. Just a suggestion. In any case, that's what's going on here. So now let's see the sweet part of the story. Eliyahu says to everybody, come close to me. They all come. And now, by the way, they all come, which means they're turning their back on the Nevi'a Baal, who are sitting there bleeding and exhausted after jumping up and down all the time. 450 guys were wiped out, and everybody's now turned their back on them. Doesn't look good for these guys. What does he do? And he heals the destroyed Mizbeach. This is a figurative notion, meaning Hashem's Mizbeach has been destroyed in a sense because the people have abandoned Hashem. He's going to heal it, and here's how we're going to do it. He takes 12 rocks to correspond with the 12 tribes. And then a strange line comes in. He has 12 rocks, which we would already recognize, it's the 12, but to correspond to the 12 Shiftei B'nei Yaakov, and then this other line is thrown in, that Hashem told him, I'm changing your name to Yisrael, next week's Parsha. Why does he throw that in? Because what is Yisrael? Why does Yaakov get the name Yisrael? What does Yaakov do to earn that name Yisrael? Remember, how did Yaakov become Israel?
He wrestles with the angel.
He's able
wrestles
to
with God, champion.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Israel is a power name. Yaakov is not a power name, and so the text puts that in because Eliyahu is, if you don't mind the figurative image, is putting on Israel's mantle, not Yaakov's mantle. Here, all right, and let's see how it plays out. He takes those 12 rocks and he builds a new Mizbeach b'shem Hashem, which means, by the way, either there was another Mizbeach that he built that he ignored, or there was no Mizbeach yet and now he builds it with those 12 stones and he says, this is b'shem Hashem. This is a little bit difficult. He creates a moat around it, which is enough to plant two se'ah, that's quite a bit, of seed. In other words, there's lots of water. The reason this is weird is because, I say this living in California, there is a drought. There's a drought for 3 years. Water is sparse. And yet, he's got all this water to put in. Okay, that's part of what the effect is. Because if you put all this water around it, what's the fire going to have to do in order to get to the Mizbeach? It's going to have to hit spot on. Nail it. Smart bomb. All right, Vayarochat Ha'itzim. He then lays out the wood, a same phrase that we're familiar with from Akedat Yitzchak. Vayinatach et apar, Vayasim al Ha'itzim. He cuts up the ox, puts the pieces on the Ha'itzim. Vayomer, Milu arba'ach ha'dimayim. And then he tells the people to fill up four jugs of water, Vayitzku al ha'olav al Ha'itzim. And pour the water on the meat and on the wood. What happens when the wood gets really wet? Not going to catch fire very well. Anybody here ever go camping? Has ever built a bonfire? Okay. What do you need to have a bonfire?
Dry kindling.
You need dry kindling, and your logs can't be green. You gotta have things that are flammable. You put water on them, you're killing yourself there. No good. He says, put water by Yomer Shnu, by Yishnu. He says, do it a second time. By Yomer Shaleshu, and do it a third time. There's tons of water. Where's this water coming from? Unclear. And the water now is circulating around the Mizbeach. And the channel is now full of water. There's water all over the place. Now again, Ba'alot HaMincha doesn't seem to connect here. When the Mincha was brought up, unclear if that's referring to what's happening here in Yerushalayim. Eliyahu now approaches. Remember, he told the people to approach. Now he approaches the Mizbeach, and he says it out loud so they all hear it. Adonai Elohei Abraham Yitzchak and now be Yisrael. Hayom Yivada. It should be known today. Ki ata Elohim be Yisrael v'ani avdecha. 2 points I want to make. A, you are the God in Israel. And second, I am your servant. In other words, uvidvarcha asite called v'ayma'ila. I did all of this at your behest, at your word. Which is a crucial thing for Eliyahu, because if you remember from last week, what was the first thing Eliyahu ever said that we heard? Im yeh talu matar ki'im lefi dvari. I am declaring a drought until I say the drought's over. And now what does Eliyahu want to clarify? Everything I've done here, I've done because you told me, Hashem. Which means, by the way, there are two reputations at stake here that are tied to each other, and Eliyahu is asking Hashem to save both. One is Hashem's reputation, the other is Eliyahu's reputation. And then he says, Aneini Adonai Aneini. V'yed'u ha'am hazeh ki ata Adonai ha'elohim. Ha'elohim, the God, in a sense, the only God. V'ata sibot aliva machoranit. And he also puts some blame in God's footsteps and feet and says, you turned their hearts backwards. Strange line. But Eliyahu seems to be quite quietly asking God to forgive the people and say, look, you didn't appear, you didn't demonstrate your power for these people, and therefore they were led astray. So now fix it by appearing manifest. What happens? You know what happens. Hashem's fire comes down. It burns up the meat, the soaked meat. It burns up the soaked wood. It burns up the rocks. It burns up the dirt. It even singes the water. Everything gets on fire. Even the water itself is on fire. Make some tea. All right. So now, you are one of the people. Let's start from this. You are one of the Nevi'ei HaBaal. What's your reaction to this? What do you think? You're one of the Nevi'ei HaBaal. What?
Run.
Oh, you might run. Okay, what's your internal reaction to this?
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh what?
Uh-oh. We may not be able to pull this off.
No, but okay, so what do you, is there anything changing in your mind now? Are you going to say, I guess we were wrong, and Baal really is nothing, and there's only one God? Probably not.
Yeah.
Probably not.
Not likely.
What, Josh, what?
Not likely.
Not likely. People rarely change their minds, and something that they're invested in becomes very hard. Mm-hmm. Debates are never presented in order to change people's minds. They're there to sway people. Debates are, A, for the people who agree with you, so they'll have more information, and B, for the undecideds. The guys who are on the other side aren't going to change their mind. The Viabal, we don't know what happens to them, although what will happen to them soon will make it certainly a moot point, and I mean moot in two languages, but the people themselves, the Amcha, the nation that's out there, they're kind of in the middle. Because what they've been doing the whole time has been saying Hashem and Baal. And now if we have some demonstration that Hashem is the only God, and he demands that we give up Baal, okay, we'll give up Baal. But if we have Baal, they're not going to say, we're wrong. Where's the nearest yeshiva? Let's go learn for a while. They're not going to say that. So watch what happens. Vayar kol ha'am vayiplu al pneihem. All right, so they all fall on their face. Adonai hu ha Elohim. Adonai hu ha Elohim. This is where it comes from. We do it at the end of Yom Kippur. 7 times it comes here. This is where it starts. Hashem is the God. Hashem is the God. All right. Vayomer Eliyahu lahem. So Eliyahu, the first thing he says is, Tifsu et Nevi'ei HaBaal. Ishali malet neyem. Vayit pesum. So he said, okay, everybody grab these Baal prophets. Vayudem Eliyahu Nachal Kishon. Eliyahu takes them down to Nachal Kishon, which is Wadi Ara. It runs just south of Haifa. It's below the Carmel. Nachon Kishon, you know from the story of Sisera and Yael, and Dvorah. Vayishchatem Sham, and Eliyahu slaughters in there. 415 of Yabal, dead in the water. And then Eliyahu turns to Achav. And by the way, remember, what is the real crisis going on? It's not a crisis of belief, and it's not a crisis of fire. It's the real crisis going on that got everybody interested in coming to Har Carmel and see the spectacle.
Rain.
Rain. There's still no rain. People came there for rain. What they saw was an unbelievable demonstration of Hashem's exclusive powers, but there's still no rain. So now, Vayomer Eliyahu le'Achav, Ale echol ushte. Go home and eat and drink. Ki kol hamon hagashem. Soon you're going to hear a rainstorm like crazy. Vayale Achav lechol v'lishto. By the way, notice who's not at this gathering? Izabel. And that'll become an important point in about 5 minutes. Vayale Achav lechol v'lishto. So he goes up to eat and drink. Vayaleahu alah al rosh ha-karmel v'yikhar artsa. He goes up to the top of the Carmel, which means where's he looking? He's looking out over the Mediterranean. And he lies on the ground. Vayasim panav ben berkav. He puts his face between his knees. It's some sort of prayerful position. Vayomer naaro. He's got an assistant, a caddy. Aleina beit derachyam. Look to the west. Vayavaya beit vayomer in mum. I don't see anything there. The sky is clear. Great day for hang gliding. Go back another time. Go back another time. Seven different times he tells him to go. The seventh time he goes, which by the way should remind us of the seven times with the that Elisha does with the boy to revive him. I see a tiny little cloud, the size of, from me, my perspective, looks like a man's palm coming up from the sea. So you better go tell Achav to Esor, which means to gird himself and go down from the mountain. So you don't get caught in the rainstorm. Now, by the way, we're in a parched land, and everything is dry, everything is brown. And he's telling Achav, you better hurry home so you don't get swept up in a rainstorm. In the meantime, suddenly the heavens get black with clouds and with wind. And there's a big rainstorm. And he goes now down into the valley to Yisrael, which is where his palace is. So Hashem supports Eliyahu, and he girds himself. And Eliyahu, after all this, runs in front of the chariot, the 20 or so miles it is to Yisrael, which is quite a feat in and of itself. That's the end of that story, but that story is not the end, because here's what happens immediately afterwards. We do need to see Perek Yutet, although we'll do it quickly. Now Achav comes home and he tells to Izabel, and by the way, what does he tell her? He tells her Eliyahu came, and Eliyahu did this thing with the fire. And Eliyahu slaughtered 450 of your court prophets. They call Shah Raga calling Vin Bacharib. Izebel's not a happy girl at this point. But Yishlach Izebel Malach, Eliyahu anymore. Eliyahu is evidently there in Israel. He ran there. So she sends a messenger to Eliyahu. Koya Sun Alim Bachoyosifun. This, by the way, is an oath. We see this phrasing already in Shmuel. Tomorrow, you're going to be like them. I'm going to kill you. I'm going to have you killed the way you killed them. Tomorrow. Now, what now? I want you to picture, after everything that's happened, what do you expect Eliyahu to do when Izabel, this one particular queen, says, I'm going to have you killed? What do you expect Eliyahu to do? After this story, what would you expect Eliyahu to do? I find what he does remarkably odd. What would you expect him to do?
Well, maybe he'd want to run away, I'm thinking. Seriously.
He is going to run away. I have a whole different option.
Right, what could he do?
No. Aneni, Hashem Aneni, and send down another fire at Izabel. Why not? Because, by the way, let's think about this. Eliyahu's got his own life on the line. Izabel puts out a contract on him. But who else is on the line here? Hashem is, because what has been just been demonstrated, Hashem is all powerful, and Eliyahu is his prophet. Now, if the representative of the Baal religion, Isabel, is able to successfully kill Eliyahu, that kind of quashes that impression. So Eliyahu, we'd expect at this point, would say, nah, sorry, you're not going to kill me. I'm going to walk right in your palace, and I'm going to kill you. Or I'm going to walk right in your palace, I'm going to have lunch. You're not going to be able to touch me, because you do, fire will come down and burn you up. Wait, why isn't Isabel even afraid? So remember, people don't give up their beliefs so quick. But Eliyahu instead does run. And we find numerous instances of this where people who are loyal to God are told to do things. And then when danger appears, instead of saying, look, Hashem sent me, it's cool, I'm okay, they bug off. A famous one example, all right, after Shaul gets fired, God fires Shaul. God then says to Shmuel, I want you to go to Beit Lechem, because one of Yishai's sons will be my king. What would we expect Shmuel to do at that point? To go to Beit Lechem. Find Yishai, find his kids, find the eighth kid or seventh kid, David, whichever version you take, and anoint him. Instead, what does Shmuel say to God? Remember? Shmuel Aleph Perek Tetzayin. What does Shmuel say to God? He says, "V'shama Shaul b'haragani." Shaul will hear that I went to anoint somebody else. He'll kill me. Now, your God, what do you say back? A, I'll protect you. B, I told you to go, so you know it's safe. C, I told you to go. Go, and you get killed, you get killed. Kiddush Hashem. You would expect that to be a non-issue. Instead, what happens? God says, you know, you got to point Shmuel. I'll give you a cover story. Take an animal and go tell him you're doing a korban. Right? Interesting. God steps in and does all these amazing miracles, and yet here, Eliyahu runs away instead of standing up and saying, look, God just made all this fire come down. What am I afraid of you for? So let's see what happens. Vayar v'yakom v'yelech el nafsho. Right? So he sees what's happening. He gets up and he goes to save his life. The first thing he does, he runs to a different country. He runs to Beersheba. Beersheba belongs to Yehuda. He leaves his caddy there. And then he wanders off. This is, by the way, what you said before, Stuart, about the picture of Navi. You know, walking off into the desert on his own. Beautiful. Right? One day's walk. He finds a brush tree. And he sits there by Shalnaf Shalamut, and he says, I want to die. Does this remind you of anybody sitting under a tree saying, I want to die? Remember last week we talked about Eliyahu and Yonah?
Yonah.
Here's another parallel. Vayomer Rav, Ata Adonai Kach Nafshi, Kilov Tov Anachim Yavotai. Take my life, I'm no better than my ancestors. Which is, by the way, kind of a chutzpahic thing to say. You know, your ancestors have to be pretty bad for you to say, I'm no better than my ancestors. Normally, we'd like to say, oh, I wish I were as good as my ancestors. But, all right, because I'm not doing any better job. Take my life from me. I can't get this job done. Eliyahu gives up. So he ends up sleeping under that tree. A malach comes and says, get up and eat. Esmankin. He gives him a cake that's cooked on tiles. It's a pachat mayim and some water. He eats, drinks, comes back to sleep. Very nice. Notice shenit, because who else gets a shenit? Yonah, remember? Hashem speaks to Yonah shenit and sends him to Nineveh. Yonah and Eliyahu, a lot of connections. The malach gets him up a second time. You got a long way to go. You're not going to sleep here. You got a journey to make. So again, he gets up, eats and drinks, and now he walks. That food sustains him for 40 days and 40 nights. Does that number sound familiar? Food sustaining you for 40 days and 40 nights? Who does that remind you of? Folks, help me out. Who does that remind you of?
Moses going up and then the flood of Noah.
Well, no, you're not eating. 40 days, he eats, and for 40 days, 40 nights, he goes.
Moses up the mountain.
Where does Eliyahu go to? On Har Ha'elim Choreb. Moshe goes to Har Sinai. Eliyahu goes to Har Sinai, middle of the desert. Vayavo Shamel Me'arai comes into the cave. What's the cave? So if you remember at Har Sinai, when Hashem forgave Bnei Israel after the Egel, then Moshe said, Harini not Podecha, I want to see your glory. Hashem says, you can't see my glory, because if you see me, you'll die. So go into a cave. It's a cleft inside the mountain. Go into the cave, and I'll pass by. I'll cover the cave. Eliyahu goes to the cave. The cave has to be the cave we already know. It seems to be the same cave. This is such a great scene. I hope you don't mind. I'm going to steal 5 minutes of your evening because it's too great of a scene. There. If you need to leave, you need to leave. And Hashem says, what are you doing here, Eliyahu? What do you mean, what are you doing here? What are you doing here? Your job is to lead people. What are you doing out here? Vayomer, watch what Eliyahu says. Kano ki neiti l'adamai l'itzalt. I was jealous for you. Ki azvu v'itcha b'nei Israel abandoned your breed. Enemies b'chotecha rasu. They destroyed your mizbachot. And nevi'echa gubachar. They killed your nevi'im. Vayvatera nida vadi. And I'm the only one left. Vayvakshut nafshi l'kachta. They want to kill me too. Very interesting take. Considering it's Yizebel who wants to kill him, and everybody else was Hashem Hu Elokim. So what's Hashem's response to this? It's interesting. You would think Hashem would respond and say, you're right, stick around here, I'll protect you, or go back, take it, or you're wrong. Instead, what is Hashem has a lesson to teach him. It's great. Go out of the cave and stand right in front of Hashem. V'nei Adonai Over. God, I'm going to pass in front of you. There will be a hurricane that breaks mountains apart. Lo baruach Adonai. God is not in the hurricane. Ruach ra'ash. And after that, there'll be an earthquake. We know what this is like. Lo barash Adonai. God's not in the earthquake. And then there will be a conflagration. Lo ba'esh Adonai. God's not in the fire. After the fire, there'll be a quiet, subdued voice. And by the way, this follows a familiar pattern in Tanakh, which we call 3+1, or al-shlosha v'al-arba'ah. Where something happens three different times and there's no resolution, the fourth time it's resolved. Three different times Shimshon lies to Delilah until finally tells the truth. Three different times Hashem calls to Shmuel for his first nevuah. Only the fourth time Shmuel realizes who it is, etc., etc. Many examples. There'll be three manifestations of God's power, but God's not in there. The fourth one is a still silent voice, and you can understand that's where God is. What's he teaching Eliyahu? Eliyahu, you tried to get the people to come around with bombast, with fire coming down, with a big explosion, fireworks, doesn't work. And a riot doesn't work is the next day they're ready to kill you. Because Yizebel would not be successful in putting out a hit on Eliyahu unless the people would back her up. For one day, the Hashem came, and the next day they were kill Eliyahu. So it's called the Mamadaka. This is a turning point in Eliyahu's career. So what happens? Eliyahu hears this, and he covers himself. What does he hear? He is evidently the still small voice. He covers his face with his cloak. He comes out to the cave, and there's a voice. And what happens? Hashem says, okay, let's try it again. Look, I put it, it's exact cut and paste job. Hashem says, okay, let me ask you again. What are you doing here? And what does he want Eliyahu to say? He wants Eliyahu to say, I shouldn't be here. I will go back immediately, God, and I will go back with the cold mamadaka to teach the people. Instead, what does Eliyahu say? Kano kine, he repeats himself, word for word, letter for letter, trump for trump mark. Exactly. It's like God says, you didn't get it. So you know what God does? It's really cool. God pink slips Eliyahu. No severance either. Go back the way you came, but go to Damascus instead of Haifa. I want you to, instead of Ben-Hadad, anoint a new king over Aram, Syria, our sworn enemies. I want you to anoint a new king, Hazael. Then go to Yehu, who's one of Ahab's generals, and anoint him as the king. And then we'll have a revolution and kill Ahab. that the Elisha ben Shaphat me'avel mecholah t'mshachol mitachtachan. Go to Avel Mecholah, which is in the Jordan Valley, and anoint Elisha as the new Navi in place of you. You're fired. It's remarkable. If anybody of my people survives the Aramean attack, then Yehu, my king, will kill them. If anybody gets away from them, Elisha will kill them. I'm going to kill them all. I'm going to leave 7,000 Jews alive. That's it. Only the people who didn't bow to Baal. All right, so now Eliyahu, we would figure at this point, okay, I got fired. Watch what happens, it's great. But Yelach Misham, inside Elisha ben Shaphat, he doesn't go to Syria, he doesn't go to Israel, he doesn't appoint a new king in either place. But inside Elisha ben Shaphat v'choresh, he finds Elisha in Avel Mecholah, and Elisha is plowing, he's out in the field. He's got 12 team of oxen in front of him. He's at number 12. And Eliyahu comes and he throws his cloak off towards Elisha, which could mean several things. The most likely thing it means is, I want you to be my caddy. So Elisha immediately gets up, leaves the animals, and runs to Eliyahu. And he realizes that Eliyahu is elevating him to this status. Let me just kiss my parents, and then I'll follow you and say goodbye to them. And Eliyahu says, go back, I didn't do anything. And what is it Eliyahu wants? Some clues. He wants Elisha to just run after him without saying goodbye to his parents. It's a little bit strange. It's all very strange. So instead, Elisha goes back and he takes team of oxen number 12 and he slaughters them. Then he took the wood yoke and turned that in, broke it down, made a fire out of it, and he cooked them there. And he gave everybody meat, celebrating the fact that he's now been elevated to Eliyahu's caddy. And he serves Eliyahu. Next week, you'll have to let me know. Let Rabbi Finkelstein know and he'll let me know. If you want to finish the story of Eliyahu in Tanakh, we could do that next week. Or if you want to take a look at some Midrashim about Eliyahu and see who becomes in rabbinic literature. But it's been delightful, and I will see you next week. Have a great week, and already stay healthy.
All right. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you then next week. Take care.